follow along with us right now on the live stream, if you go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, scroll down to under recent sermons, and click on the link for February 23, lesson 255, and then you can load the notes and follow along as we go through them here in class. So everybody should have in front of you a set of notes for lesson 255, Assessing the Printed History of the King James Text, Blaney and the 1769 Oxford Text. So we started looking at Blaney two, three lessons ago, and so we're going to continue with that here this morning. Alright? So let's get right into things. Introduction. In lesson 254, we began looking at the editorial work of Benjamin Blaney that Benjamin Blaney conducted for Oxford University Press in preparation for their 1769 edition. In doing so, we consider the following categories of revision. So this would have been in the last lesson, alright? So what did we look at? We looked at changes to the number of a noun. We looked at changes in the verb tense and usage. We looked at restoration of 1611 readings. And then fourthly, we looked at the correction of printer errors. So in 254, last week, that's what we looked at, those 4 points. Okay? So while I have this note in here again, please, well, let me just stop for 1 second. Okay? So after the teaching of last week's lesson, I once again heard from Christopher Yetzer in Italy, and he shared with me some additional information. I'm working on putting some of that into the notes from last week online, all right? I did not decide to go over that new information here right now in this lesson just because it's still being worked on. So when it's done, I might elect to do like a standalone update on that, but for now we're just going to move ahead, alright? But he did find some instances where some of the things we looked at in these 4 categories from last week were actually changed in earlier editions, which is somewhat a theme now that we've been seeing over the last number of weeks, okay? Now, as far as these notes, these are the ones that I looked at. These are the editions that I checked, alright? So please note that for all of the examples listed below, we checked the readings in the following editions. So I started with a 1611. I always start there. We looked at the 1629 Cambridge Folio. I looked up the 1638 Cambridge Folio. This 1683 Cambridge Quarto. So this is the work of Scattergood. Now we know that this was Anthony Scattergood that edited that edition for Cambridge University Press. I looked at a 1762 Cambridge Folio and a 1769 Oxford Folio. So for all of the ones, all the examples that we looked at, or that we're going to cover in this lesson, I at least looked at all of those. In a few of these, you're going to see some additional ones that I also checked that aren't listed here. This list covers all the examples. I checked all of these for every one. There were some I looked at some more for because I had reason to believe that I needed to. Okay? So, time and space, to save time and space, I have not provided photographic evidence of every example from all the editions listed above, but only what is necessary to explain each example. That said, every edition listed was checked for each example. So that's kind of what I said already. So what are we going to be looking at in this lesson? We're going to consider the following additional points. First, we're going to look at word changes, modern forms and idioms. Second, changes in the use of definite articles. And third, apostrophes and possessive forms. Those are the 3 types of revisions or categories of revisions that we're going to be looking at in this particular lesson. So if you go to page 2, we start talking about our first category, which is word changes, modern forms, and idioms. So recall from lesson 251 that F.S. Paris is attributed incorrectly with being the first to change 80 in 1 Kings 6:1. According to Gordon Campbell in Bible, the story of the King James Version 1611 to 2011, the change had been made previously in the 1683 Cambridge Quarto, which we now know is edited by Anthony Scattergood, okay, the edition prior to the work of Paris. Later, when discussing Blaney's work, Dr. Campbell mentions a similar type of changes. So, and he's going to mention here 1 Kings chapter 16, verse 23, and here's the quote there, indented. And just as Paris corrected an ordinal number, so Blaney substituted first for one in 1 Kings 16, verse 23, and that's Campbell, page 140, where he mentions this. Okay? Now, if you look at the notes here, the reason I bring this up about Paris and this change in his editions from 4 score to 80th is because this one we're going to look at, a change from 1st to 1, seems like the same kind of a thing, right? 4 score, is that the same as 80?
Yeah.
1st and 1, is 1 the same as 1st?
Yeah.
Okay? Now, remember that Paris, this was attributed to Paris by Campbell, and we know from additional looking around now that that's not true, that the change had been made previously in 1683 Cambridge Quarto, right? Then, Blaney, he discusses a similar example here with Blaney on page 140. Look at the next point. Professor David Norton discusses this example from Blaney on page 110 of A Textual History of the King James Bible in a lengthy paragraph on English word changes. So let's look at the example here. Alright, so we've got 1 Kings 16:23. Notice the reading of the 1611. In the 31 year of the king. Okay? So you see the word in question here is what?
One.
Then if you look at Blaney's work from 1769, notice what it says, in the 30th and what?
First
year. So is that a word change? Is that a word change from 1 to 1st?
Yeah.
Does it change the meaning of the verse?
No.
Doesn't change anything about the meaning of the verse, right? We're still talking about the 31st year. Whether you say 30 and 1 or 30 and 1st year of Asa, it's the same thing. Now there might be other changes in that verse that you could point out, but remember we're only looking right now at the ones that Blaney made in 1769. Okay? So this is an example of that sort of a, you know, first for one kind of a change. It's definitely a word change between the 1611 and the 1769. All right. Any questions about that one before we move on? The next one is Ezekiel 1:17. Professor Campbell also discusses a change made by Blaney to Ezekiel 1:17. Quote. In the prophetic passage about the wheel, in the middle of the wheel, he changed, they returned not when they went, to the clearer, they turned not when they went. So the change there is the difference between returned and what?
Turned.
So let's go to the top of the next page, page 3. Dr. Norton also lists this example in a paragraph on word changes found on page 110 of his textual history. So, what neither Campbell nor Norton mention is that this change made by Blaney in 1769 brought Ezekiel 1:17 into alignment with verses 9 and 12 in the same chapter. Please consider the following images from the 1611, okay? So let's look first at verse 1. Notice, it says here, some of the font is difficult sometimes, their wings were joined one to another, they turned not. So the word here in verse 9 is what?
Turned.
Same chapter, look at verse 12. Okay? Again it says, and they what?
Turned
not. So verse 9 has turned. Verse 12 has what?
Turned.
And then verse 17 in the same chapter, and they returned not when they went. Returned is in the 1611 here at verse 17. In the same chapter, in the same context, two other times it says what?
Turned.
Okay? So according to Campbell and Norton, this change to verse 17 was first made by Blaney in 1769. So let's check that against some important prominent editions. Alright? So here's Blaney's 1769 Oxford Folio. Okay? And notice the change now in verse 17 is to what?
Turned.
So does that bring that verse then in line, using the same word as verse 12, the same word as verse what?
9.
So you could argue or make the argument here that the change there is being made to make it consistent with verse 12 and verse 9. Okay? Any questions there? Okay, so the next one is 2 Chronicles 16:6, top of page 4. Professor Campbell also notes the modernization of an idiom in Blaney's 1769 text at 2 Chronicles 16:6. He, referring to Blaney, also modernized archaic idioms. So, was a building becomes was building. Okay? So, to say was a building is to use sort of an older idiom, an older form or an older, you know, expression. To change it to was building is to obviously modernize that clause to make it a more of a modern construct. Dr. Norton also covers this change on page 111 of his textual history. So let's look at it again. Here we have the 1611. We're talking about this part right here, was a building. So the 1611 had was a building in the text. That stayed that way all the way as far as I could tell in all the editions that I checked. I'm not saying there's not one out there that I haven't looked at that doesn't make this change. But in 1769 folio, you can see right here that is changed to simply was what?
Building.
Building. So let's just make sure we got it. Was a building becomes simply was what?
Building.
Building. Okay? Any questions on that one?
I wonder if that used to be one word, a building.
You mean even before 1611?
Yeah.
Could be. I haven't checked that. Maybe it would have. Yep, we'd have to look it up. Yeah, it sounds like it's. Hey, I was a diggin', or something like that. It sounds like just a colloquial way of saying something that we would no longer necessarily view as sort of proper English. You know what I'm saying? I have also heard. Maybe I'll just say it this way, I'm not trying to be offensive, but Southern expressions that kind of sound like was a building or was a doing or was a this or was a that. Yeah. And so Blaney decides that it's not necessary, so he takes out what? The A. So again, is this a word change?
Word removal.
It's a word removal. It's a change, right? So, but it's not substantive. It doesn't change anything. It's just a different way of saying the same thing. Okay? Next one is 2 Chronicles 34:10. 2 Chronicles 34:10 is listed by Dr. Norton on page 110 of a textual history of the King James Bible as an example of a word change by Blaney. Alright, so let's look at this. What we're talking about right here, here's the 1611 folio, and we're talking about the end of the verse right here, to repair and mend the house. Okay? So you see that word is what?
Mend.
M-E-N-D. Okay? Go to top page 5. Notice Blaney's folio from 1769 to repair and amend the house. So he sticks a what? A in there. Okay? So that's the change that he makes. Okay? It's.
Mend means repair, so if you, and amend means to change, right?
I think amend can mean to repair
like,
as well.
It would sound kind of stupid to say to basically to mend and mend. Maybe meant to leave the beat off and just it was a final repair.
Repair amen?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think if we look up amend, you're going to see that there's a meaning of amend that's related to repair. Or the same thing as mend.
Oh, so amend dealt more with literature or writing to amend a proclamation or amend. Amend, like you would mend clothes, but amend, that's what I mean, like a document.
To correct or alter respect to wording or argument, man, there's too many of these to go through. I'm just going to say, without looking deeply in it because it's going to take too much time, that it means the same thing. And I'm surmising that if you look up amend, you'll find a meaning of it that means the same thing as mend. It's just, again, the spellings on these things were different. By the time you get from 1611 to 1769, Blaney apparently thinks that the A before amend makes it make more sense or something along those lines. Okay. Now, back to page 5, there's another example here, Judith 2:20, which is from the Apocrypha, is also tagged by Professor Norton on page 110 as a verse that received editorial revision by Blaney. I didn't give you a screenshot of this because it's from the Apocrypha, but the 1611 notice, a great multitude also of sundry countries, is changed in 1769 by Blaney to say a great number also of sundry countries. So the change is from multitude to what? Number. So great multitude versus what? Great number. All right. So there's a wording change there. It's apocryphal. I'm not really all that concerned about it because you guys know I don't take the Apocrypha as being scripture. Okay. So that's the end of the first category. In the first category, again, we were looking at word changes, modern forms, and idioms. All right. Anybody have any questions about the revisions there from the first category? Okay, the second point or category we're going to look at is changes in the use of the definite article or articles. On page 108, Norton suggests changes made by Blaney in the use of definite articles. He says, quote, most of the remaining corrections for literal accuracy deal with articles, most commonly inserting an omitted definite article. That's from page 108. In footnote 12, Norton ascribes 5 such changes to the work of Benjamin Blaney in 1769. So he mentions Deuteronomy 20, verse 7. He mentions Psalms 99, verse 2, Isaiah 44, verse 13, Acts 18, verse 5, 1 Corinthians 10, verse 28 are the ones that he says fit this category of changes in the use of the definite article. So let's look at this. The first one is Deuteronomy 20, verse 7, okay? And notice this part right here. Lest he die in battle. Okay, so we're talking about right here. Lest he die in battle. That's the one that is changed by Blaney. So here it is. Same clause. Lest he die in the battle. So does Blaney insert the definite article the in 1769?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, so it's a change. There's an additional word that's added there by Blaney, the definite article. So that's this category. Let's look at Psalm 99, verse 2. Page 6, I believe we're on, right? Psalm 99, verse 2. Notice right here, he is high above all people, 1611. And then the 1769 Blaney folio, he is high above all the people. Again, insertion of the definite article the in front of people is made by Blaney. For the first time that I know of, again, I checked all the ones that I mentioned earlier, it's made for the first time that I know of in this edition by Blaney, and I believe that's the standard reading. I see you looking at it, Amy.
It's got the battle in verse 5, so to put it the in 7 to kind of
verse 2. Which one are you in? Are you still looking at the one from
Deuteronomy 20, verse 5 and 7?
Okay. Right. So Psalm 99, verse 2, we'd see the same thing again, the insertion of the definite article, so again a word is added. Isaiah 44, verse 11. Okay? Now, again, we're only looking at the ones made by Blaney to these verses. You could make the argument that there's more here. I didn't stop to do that. Notice this clause right here. He maketh it out with the line. Notice the I have underlined in red. Notice the verse in the 1769. Okay? I read this wrong. Marketh is the correct, not maketh, it's marketh. Sorry. So, he marketh it out with a line versus what? The line. So, a change again in the use of the definite article is being made by Blaney to this verse here in Isaiah 44, verse 13. All right? Let's look at Acts 18, verse 5.
I think you read it right in the 1611. I think it is Maketh. And then 1669, it is Marketh.
So there was a change there?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me just look at that quick. does look like maketh in 1611, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Versus marketh. Because there's no R in the 1611.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there's a difference we weren't even anticipating of another. Again, are any of these changes substantive? They're not altering anything that the text is communicating. Acts 18, verse 5. Notice, Paul was pressed in spirit, 1611. Okay? 1769, notice, Paul was pressed in the spirit. It's capital, it's lowercase. He's referring there to his own one. His own spirit, not the Holy Spirit, right? But it's a change from nothing in spirit to in the what? Spirit. So is there an added word that does Blaney have the definite article? All right? 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 28. Okay? Notice, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. So I have this underlined right here. All right? Go to the next page. Look at 1769. Notice, for the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. So the word for inserted into the verse by Delaney in 1769. So Amy, would you mind checking that one? Look up 1 Corinthians 10:28. And it reads how?
For
the earth is the Lord's, right? So Blaney inserts the four in front of this the way it was in the 1611.
That asterisk
is there. The asterisk is a marginal note. It doesn't have. I looked at this. It doesn't have anything to do with whether there should be a four there or not. Okay. All right. So in that category, we've seen changes to verses related to definite articles, etc. Okay. So, does anybody have any questions before we move to the third point, which is the longest point? Now look, guys, again, is the 1611 reading exactly the same way as the 1769? Are there word changes, additions, subtractions, etc., to what is being said? So again, we have to have a position that takes account of the relevant facts. Otherwise, it seems to me the position is of no practical value. All right? Anyone want to say anything else about that before we get point three? Okay, this is going to be the longest and probably the most technical of what we're going to talk about here this morning. So we should have enough time to do this. So point three is about apostrophes and possessive forms. All right? So, in lesson 251, we looked at apostrophes and possessive forms in the work of F.S. Paris. In doing so, we observed the following from the pen of Gordon Campbell. Quote, this is page 134 of Campbell. He says, in the 1611 Bible, possessives were indistinguishable from normative forms. Okay? But in the second quarter of the 18th century, apostrophes had begun to represent possessive forms. Paris therefore inserted possessive apostrophes throughout the text. So let's just stop right there. So in 1611, were people using apostrophes in English?
No.
The use of apostrophes to indicate possessive forms did not come into use until the 1700s. Okay? So we can look at any of these editions on this point throughout the 1600s. And you're not going to find the use of apostrophes. Those aren't going to be used until you get to the editorial work of Paris and then later Blaney. Okay? And they're going to not agree with each other on the use of apostrophes, as we're going to see as we look at this. Okay? Now, look at the next point. The following examples were considered in lesson 251 of this category of revision from Paris's work. So in lesson 251, we looked at all of these examples. Okay? So, first, we looked at the 1743 duodecimo edition of Paris, H1063, okay? So I didn't give you all the pictures again, because we've already covered this, but I wanted you to see the list, because there's some reasons why, alright? Notice, Judges 11:2, Wives, Sons, the apostrophe S, okay? I'll explain why some of these are bold in a minute, alright? 1 Chronicles 7:2, father's house. 7:40, father's house. Nehemiah 7:61, father's house. Psalm 6:4, mercy's sake. And then notice I have an asterisk on all of these. Okay, I'll get to what that means in a minute. Okay, so Psalm 6:4, mercy's sake. Psalm 31:16, mercy's sake. Psalm 44:26, mercy's sake. Psalm 140:3, adder's poison. Daniel 2:41, potter's clay. And I have all of these, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, all marked with an asterisk. Okay? Then we have Matthew 14:9, oath's sake. And we have Mark 6:29, oath's sake. Alright, now, notice what the asterisk means here. Okay? The asterisk indicates that the apostrophe was removed in the 1762 Cambridge, Quarto, and Folio editions. So what does that mean? That means in 1743, the ones with the asterisk, did they have the apostrophe S?
Yes.
Yes. But when you move forward in time from there to Paris's later work in 1762, be it his quarto or his folio, all of these apostrophes had been what?
Removed.
On the ones that have the asterisk. Does that make sense? Is everybody clear on what that is telling you? Okay, so we further, in lesson 251, we looked at 1762 Cambridge Quarto, H1134, and 1762 Cambridge Folio, H11. So would this still be the work of Paris? Okay, so notice Ezekiel 44:30, priests, wisdom of Solomon, 15:4, printers, Ecclesiasticus 13:19, lions prey, Baruch 1:4, king's sons, and 1 Maccabees 10:89, king's blood. Alright? So what does this mean? This means that this list here is Paris's work from 1743. This list here is Paris's work from 1762. Did he clearly, early on, put some apostrophes in that he later removed? Yes. Alright? Is everybody good with that so far? So page 9. So Paris clearly changed his mind. All right. Now, recall from above that Campbell said, quote, in the second quarter of the 18th century, apostrophes had begun to represent possessive forms. Paris therefore inserted possessive apostrophes throughout the text. How should we view this category of editorial revision? We talked about option 1 being a spelling change. We talked about option 2 being a grammatical update to reflect conventions for distinguishing between possessive and normative forms in the English language. And I told you when I taught lesson 151 that I think the correct view is option 2, that this is a grammatical update to reflect conventions for indicating possessive forms. Okay? Remember we talked about all that? I know you all have perfect knowledge of that. That wasn't that long ago. The test will be next week. Yeah, I know. Someday I'm just going to bring in a test and lock the door and say, you're not leaving until you pass this test. That's right. So, Professor David Norton also discusses the insertion of apostrophes by Paris and Blaney on page 109 of A Textual History of the King James Bible. He says, quote, some of these examples cross the line between matters of accuracy and matters of English, as does another group of variants from these editors, apostrophes. Among the variant readings are 18 apostrophes that survive from Paris and 8 from Blaney. Okay? To judge from these and from the lack of contemporary rules, they may have regarded apostrophes as a matter of mere orthography. And then he quotes from Robert Loth. So if you follow the 16 there, drop down here to the 16 down here. This is footnote 16. Robert Loth's A Short Introduction to English Grammar, which appeared the same year as Paris's edition, does not mention possessive apostrophes. Okay? So what he's basically saying is the same thing I'm saying. Is this a spelling, is this a mere orthography spelling deal, or is this a grammatical convention update to insert the apostrophe? All right? He's saying that that it's unclear, Norton is saying it's unclear to him exactly how to think about this. Okay? At least that's what I perceive him to be saying. Moving on with this quote, starting with curiously. Okay? Curiously, all those noted from Paris, except Ptolemy's, 2 Maccabees 1:10, are placed before the S, whereas Blaney's usually follow the S. Consequently, modern editions have nine singular possessives that should be plural, 7 inherited from Paris, 2 from Blaney, and another 6 that should have been singular from Blaney. A century later, Scribner corrected these, but his changes were not adopted. So, in other words, what Norton is saying is that are you going to find editions, even today, that are inconsistently apostrophized? I don't know if that's a word, but it is now. Okay? You guys understand what I'm saying? And then if you look at footnote 17 here, which I gave you, he talks about some different categories here. He talks about Paris's misplaced apostrophes. We'll talk about that in a minute. He talks about Blaney's singulars for plurals. He talks about Paris having 2 errors. And then he talks about some that Blaney changed Paris's correct rendering. And then he talks about one from Deuteronomy 23:25. So he gives a couple different categories of these apostrophe changes. So look at the bottom of page 9. Norton breaks down his discussion regarding the use of apostrophes into multiple categories. He essentially talks about 3 in the way I understand the footnote. Okay, he talks about Paris's misplaced apostrophes, Blaney's singular for plurals, and then he talks about Blaney's changes to Paris's readings. Okay, so go to page 10. So, notice first category, Paris's misplaced apostrophes. According to footnote 9, on page 109, I'm sorry, I can't read. According to footnote 17, on page 109, Norton says the apostrophes added by Paris were misplaced in 1 Chronicles 7:2, 7:40, Ezekiel 44:30, Wisdom 15:4, Ecclesiasticus 13:9, Matthew 14:9, and Mark 6:26. Okay? Note that from the list above, that these verses, see the bolded verses, the apostrophes added by Paris in his 1743 duodecimo were accepted unchanged into the Cambridge 1762 Cambridge Quarto and 1762 Cambridge Folio. So let's go back up here briefly. So what do all these bolded ones mean? These bolded ones mean that the change was made in 1743, and did the 1762 editions accept those changes without further revision? Does that make sense? Okay. So, I'm trying to be clear here, and it's a little bit of a technical point. So, what I'm trying to get you to see is that from this list, the ones that are bolded from Paris's work from 1743 get accepted into the 1762 without change. Okay? So let's go back to page 10. Look at the next point. A comparison of all the verses listed by Norton in this category reveals that Blaney retained all the changes. So all those verses that we just mentioned, all the verses in bold, 1 Chronicles 7:2, 1 Chronicles 7:40, Ezekiel 44:30, Wisdom 15:4, Ecclesiasticus 13:19, Matthew 14:9, and Mark 6:26. Okay, for all those verses, go to the next point. A comparison of all the verses listed by Norton in this category reveals that Blaney retained all the changes. Therefore, I'm not sure why Norton calls these apostrophes, quote, misplaced in his classification system. Blaney agreed with Paris by allowing these apostrophes to stand without further revision. Norton's statement appears to reflect his subjective preference. So I don't really know what he means when he says these are misplaced, if Blaney accepted those apostrophes exactly the way Paris had them. Does everybody understand what I'm getting at? So I don't know why Norton is choosing to describe that category as Paris's misplaced apostrophes. Now, I could be missing something and it just isn't apparent to me what he's getting at, but I'm pretty sure that if we check all of these, I looked at a standard 1769 for all these verses and they were all the same as what Paris had for the ones that are bolded in that list. Does that make sense? Okay? If that's clear, we can move on. The next category is Blaney's singular for plurals. In this category, Norton notes two verses for which Blaney included apostrophes, whereas Paris omitted them. Ezra 2:59 and Nehemiah 7:61. Unfortunately for Norton, this is not the entire story. In the case of Ezra 2:59, Paris originally added an apostrophe to Father's House in his 1743 Duodecimo, H. 1063 edition, only to remove it later in his 1762 Folio and Quarto editions. The same could be said for Nehemiah 6:1. Okay? Now remember, why is Norton technically wrong? The reason he's wrong here is because he only looked at the 1762 folio. He did not look at the 1743 duodecimo lesser edition or smaller size. So, let's look at the photographic evidence. Here's Ezra 2:59. Okay? Notice, right here, their father's what? House. Apostrophe S?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay? Paris's next edition, Ezra 2:59, 1762 Cambridge Quarto, has he removed the apostrophe?
Yeah.
Okay. Look at the folio, 1762 folio. Is the apostrophe removed again?
Yeah.
So here's what you need to see. Okay. When Norton makes the comment that we just read, he only looked at this. He did not look at what? The duodecimo. He only looked at the 1762 Cambridge folio. So, did he miss the fact that at one point Paris had edited that verse by putting an apostrophe S in Fathers? Okay? Is everybody with that? Okay, so now let's look at Blaney's. Ezra 2:59. What do we see?
Apostrophe S.
Okay? So, we got to be careful again with Norton and Campbell because they're not have we as a function of this class looked at more editions than what these guys looked at when they wrote these books. Remember, they only looked at the flagship folio editions. They did not look at these what I'm calling lesser editions, and by lesser I just simply mean again smaller size, okay? So, let's look at the next one, Nehemiah 761, page 11. So it's the same story as what we just saw. So here is Paris, 1743 Cambridge Duodecimo. Does he have the apostrophe S on Father's House? Then we look at 1762 Cambridge Quarto, also edited by Paris. What's removed? The apostrophe. 1762 Cambridge Folio. What's removed? Apostrophe, and then finally Blaney's work from 1769, what is reinserted? The apostrophe. So again, Norton missed this because all he looked at were the folio editions. Okay? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Alright. Let me get caught up here. So anybody, before we move on, does anybody have a question before we look at the next subcategory? Yeah, my guess would be that these began to be used in other literature before these editors added them to the Bible. That would be my guess. Okay. Let's look at Blaney's plurals for singulars. Okay. In this category, Dr. Norton includes verses where Blaney changed Paris's singular forms to plurals. These verses include Psalm 6:4, Psalm 31:16, 44:26, 140 verse 3, Proverbs 31 verse 14, and Daniel 2:41. Okay? Once again, Norton is only seeing part of the story. All of these verses, with the exception of Proverbs 31:14, were originally possessives in Paris's 1743 Cambridge duodecimo, and were subsequently changed in his 1762 folio and quarto editions. So again, Norton is not giving the reader the full picture because he only looked at the folios. So let's look at these. Now some of these we saw already. Look at Psalm 6:4. Notice, for thy mercy's sake. So this is 1743 duodecimo. Mercies is what? Apostrophe S. Look at 1762 Cambridge quarto. The apostrophe is gone. Okay? And the spelling is different.
Yes.
Here we have 1762 Cambridge folio. Again, the apostrophe is gone, and is the spelling the same as this spelling here from this other 1762? All right? And then let's look at Blaney's 1769. Notice mercy's apostrophe where?
After the S.
Have you found the verse?
Yeah.
And it's S apostrophe, right? So it matches the 1769 Oxford folio, right?
Yeah.
Okay. You remember when we went through this before, a couple weeks back? I think Amy was checking, and we noticed that the apostrophes were different from what even Paris had. That's because Paris had them in 1743, then he took them out. And then Blaney puts apostrophes back in, but in a different spot. Okay?
If they were beginning to be used in 1743, then it doesn't seem logical that they would remove them later on.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely seems logical that there would be some change.
Yeah.
For sure. All right, let's look at the next one. Psalm 31:16. Psalm 31:16. Notice Cambridge Court, 1743 duodecimo. Again, mercy's sake, apostrophe S. 1762 quarto, mercies. 1762 folio, mercies. 1769 Blaney edition, mercies, S apostrophe. Same phenomenon we just saw. The next one, Psalm 44, verse 26, is going to be exactly the same. 1743 duodecimo, mercies, apostrophe S. Quarto, mercies, no apostrophe. Folio, 1762, mercies, no apostrophe. Psalm 44:26, 1769 Blaney, mercies, S apostrophe. Same phenomenon, and the same thing. Well, let's look at the next one, which is Psalm 140, verse 3. Notice adder's poison. This is 1743. In 1743, does Paris put the apostrophe there for adder's poison?
No.
Then we can go to 1762. Is the apostrophe removed? That's the folio. Okay, and then we can go to 1769, Oxford, which is Blaney's work. Now we have adder's S what? Apostrophe. So all these changes are being made. Now here's a new one, alright? So Proverbs 31:14. Proverbs 31:14. Notice, merchant ships. This is 1762 Cambridge quarto, merchant ships. 1762 Cambridge folio, again, merchant ships. Okay? 1769 Oxford folio, merchant's ships, S apostrophe. Okay. Any questions? So I got to get caught up here. Page 15. Norton thinks that this change by Blaney at Proverbs 31:14 altered what he perceived to be the correct reading provided by Paris. That's his opinion. I'm not sure I agree with it. Okay, but I just include it there for accuracy's sake. All right, and then we got the next page, page 16. Daniel 2:41. Here we have the same thing. 1743, potter's clay, apostrophe S on potters in 1743. 1762, quartos and folios, potter's clay, no apostrophe, folio, potter's clay, no apostrophe. 1769, Oxford folio, potter's clay, S apostrophe. Okay? So look, are these changes? Now, this next one is going to be somewhat technical. I want to address something before we talk about this one that's not in the notes. Okay, so let me make sure I get the right verse here. So bear with me for 1 second. So, everybody turn your Bible to Genesis 40, verse 7. So look at the let's look at the 1611 on the screen. Okay? Now watch. So this is 1611, 40, verse 7. And he asked Pharaoh's officers that they that were with him in the ward of his Lord's house, saying, "Wherefore look ye so sadly today?" Okay? I want to point out two words to you, okay? First, look here at Pharaoh's. Then look here at Lord's. Alright? So in the 1611, are there any apostrophes in these verses, in those spots?
Yes.
In the 1611, are there apostrophes? No. So notice he asked Pharaoh's officers. Now, there's no apostrophe here to indicate possessive, but is it pretty clear from the statement that we're talking here about the officers that belong to Pharaoh?
Yes.
Even though there's no apostrophe. Okay? And then you come down here, with him in the ward of his Lord's house. So is it pretty clear that even though there's no apostrophe on Lord's, that we're talking here about the house that belongs to the Lord?
Yes.
Not the Lord Almighty, but the Lord here, His Lord. You know, you follow what I'm saying, right? So, what I'm getting at in bringing this up is to show you that many times, even though there's no apostrophe, is it still pretty clear what's going on in the context of when you read it, even though there's no apostrophe in the text? Okay, now let's look at the modern reading. Notice, and he asked Pharaoh's officers. So what's inserted, obviously? The apostrophe, right? The same as it's same as here too with Lord's what? House. So it's not like it's not like when you look at a 1611 compared to a 1769, like things were wholly unintelligible. What is happening is that as the English language is changing over time, our apostrophe is becoming an accepted way of indicating possession in written language, right? So I don't know exactly when the apostrophe possessive was added to this verse, or there's two of them in this verse, which is why I picked this verse, but is it clear, if you just make a comparison here, that the 1611 is not exactly the same, because the 1769 has apostrophes and the 1611 didn't. But if you're reading that in 1611, and if you're a careful reader, is it going to be pretty clear that we're talking about the officers that belong to Pharaoh? Does that make sense? So the use of the apostrophe then becomes just a clear way of signaling to the reader in English that we're talking here about what? Possession. Okay? Now the reason I bring all that up is because of the example here in Deuteronomy chapter, we have 10 minutes, I'm going to try to get this, okay? This one in Deuteronomy. So I'm going to go to Deuteronomy in the 1611. Just give me a minute to find it. Deuteronomy 23:25. So this came up this week in a video that Alex and I made talking about some revisions that had been made here to this verse, right? So let's look at this. So verse 24, this is the 1611, okay? When thou comest into thy neighbor's vineyard, neighbors has no what? Apostrophe, but is it clear that we're talking about the one level, the vineyard that belongs to your neighbors?
Right.
Your neighbor. Okay? So, in other words, is possession implied in the construct?
Yes.
Okay? Then thou mayest eat grapes thy fill, and thine own, at thine own pleasure, but thou shalt not put any in thy vessel. So in other words, I guess if you come into your neighbor's vineyard and you're hungry, you can eat some of his grapes, but you can't stick him in your cloak and take some home for later. That's the way I basically understand that verse, right? But now look at this. When thou comest into the standing corn of thy neighbors. Alright? So, we're talking about the standing corn of thy neighbors. Does this seem to imply possession? Or not. It's not as clear to me that we're talking here about possession, possessive, as we were up here. Okay? But there are some that will say, of thy neighbors indicates possessive here. Even though there's no apostrophe on the S. Is everybody with me so far? But then read on. That thou mayest pluck the ears with thy hand, but thou shalt not move a sickle into thy neighbor's standing corn. Okay? So the question then is, this one here in verse 24 seems very clear to me. Neighbor's vineyard seems very clear to indicate possession. This one is not as clear to me. The first thy neighbor's in verse 25, and then thy neighbor's standing corn down here, right? So what's going on? Now I know in your Bible, all some of you have turned to a 1769 and you're looking at this, right? This neighbors in verse 24 has an apostrophe. Correct?
Yeah.
Go to verse 25. The first neighbors doesn't say neighbors, it says what?
Neighbor.
Singular. And down here, neighbors standing corn has what? An apostrophe. Alright? So, let's go back to the notes. Deuteronomy 23:25 is the last example of a possessive change attributed to Blaney by Dr. Norton, page 109. Regarding this change, Norton finds that Paris's reading to be correct and Blaney's revision defensible. So I don't really know. Again, it's another vagueness in my opinion regarding Norton. Now, Alex Boyko and I recently recorded a video on this example titled Deuteronomy 23:25 as an example of editorial change. Chat with Alex Boyko. Interested parties are encouraged to check it out. Alex also prepared a PDF document that I utilized to prepare this section of the notes. All right. So let's look at verse 25. Here's a 16:11. I just showed it to you. But thy neighbors does not have a what? Apostrophe. So this would be the first neighbors in verse 25. Okay. Now let's go to the work of Scattergood. Look at 1677 Cambridge Quarto. Notice, what change do we see?
Singular.
The S is gone. Okay? Thy neighbor would imply the corn of how many neighbors?
One.
Seemed to me to be one. Okay? Look at the 1683 Cambridge Quarto. Okay? Standing corn of thy what? Neighbor. So Scattergood in 1677 and 1683, did he take the S out? Yeah. So if you look at my little note there, one of these is wrong. I got to fix it. Mike pointed it out to me. Is it this one? Yeah, this one I have backwards. We're going to have to edit it. The 1677 and 1683 Cambridge Quarto editions edited by Anthony Scattergood changed neighbor from plural. We need to just rework this whole sentence. The point is, it was neighbors with an S, and he changes it to what?
Neighbor
without the S. Okay? Look at the 1743 Cambridge Duodecimo. So this is Paris's first run, and notice, what does it say?
Neighbor.
So does he retain Scattergood's change? Okay, so F.S. Paris, in his initial work of 1743, retained the editorial work of Scattergood by keeping neighbor singular in Deuteronomy 23:25, and then look at his 1762 folio. Now all of a sudden he says what? Neighbor's possessive S. Okay, into the standing corn of thy what? Neighbor's possessive S. Before, there's no what? There's no, there's not even an S. It's just neighbor. Okay? And then look at the next one. So Paris departs from his first reading from 1743 in his 1762 Cambridge Folio edition and makes neighbors possessive. Then we come to Deuteronomy 23:25. Okay? And notice again, so this would have been Blaney, and he says, corn of thy what?
Neighbor.
So the debate over the video that Alex and I made is this understood automatically to be a possessive in the first neighbor of verse Deuteronomy 23:25, or is the difference between the S and the no S the difference between singular versus what?
Plural.
Okay? The way Alex and I explained it was that it's a difference between singular versus plural in this case. I still tend to see it that way based upon what the evidence seems to suggest here, okay? But there are others online who saw it different than the way that we explained it. So let's just finish this up. Blaney, in his 1769 Oxford Folio, reverts to Scattergood's reading from the 1670s and 1680s in Deuteronomy 23:25 by marking neighbor singular, not plural. Okay? So Deuteronomy 23:25 then is a clear example of an editorial change, not a printer's error. The difference between plural and singular does not change the meaning of the verse as demonstrated by the context and the underlying Hebrew, which is singular on this one right here for neighbor. The thing that's tricky is that so are the other ones singular. So what do you do? So why should we view this one this way and this one with an apostrophe S? Other than the clear flow of the context of what's being talked about, okay? I still, after looking at this for quite a long time and talking to some others, can understand the issue between possessive versus singular plural. I still tend to view this one here as a singular plural issue versus a possessive. So, that basically brings us to the end of our time.
The last neighbor with an apostrophe S, that indicates that the neighbor is singular. It's belonging to the neighbor. So, that corresponds to
this neighbor,
neighbor,
the neighbor that has the standing corn,
right.
That corn is in the possession of that neighbor that has the standing corn. Otherwise, it would seem to me to be that all of the neighbors have what?
Corn.
Standing corn, which may or may not be the case. The text never says. Okay? So, I just leave you with all that. So, you know, it's some of these things get pretty technical when you think through, you know, what's going on. Right? So, we have to quit by a function of time. Appreciate everybody's attention. Now, where we're going next is we're going to start talking about a fun topic.
Ooh.
And that is italics. The italics in the text and the differences in italicization between the different editions. So, we'll start getting into that next Sunday.